This episode is sponsored by our 7th Row members. The support of our members makes this podcast and everything else we do at 7th Row possible. To find out more about membership, go to 7th-row.com/join. Welcome to the 7th Row Podcast, a weekly podcast in which we focus on under-the-radar, female-directed, and foreign films, and discuss how they engage with the world. I'm your host, Alex Heaney, Editor-in-Chief of 7th Row. 7th Row is a nonprofit publishing house dedicated to helping viewers engage in political conversations through the lens of cinema. We're invested in how film can be a catalyst to help people understand and think about social structures and social change. Okay, so on today's episode, we will be discussing some of the highlights from the Berlinale, which happened in like mid-February. We didn't attend in person, but we had a ton of screeners and we had a bunch of films that we thought were worth talking about. So that's this episode. So I think the most closely related episodes, one is we did two episodes on the Berlinale last year in 2021. And since those are more than 6 months old, they are now only available to members. And for a free episode, you could check out an episode we recorded about one of our favorites from last year, 121, where we talk about Ninja Baby. That was in the Generation section last year at Berlin, and we talked about that with Obvious Child and about the two films and how they deal with unwanted pregnancies.
So if you want to become a member, which means that you can listen to all our podcast episodes older than 6 months and listen to our bi-weekly bonus episodes. For example, last week we did one on the TV show This Is Going to Hurt and how it discusses physician mental health. Then you can become a member at 7th-row.com/join. It gets you those podcast perks and it gets you a whole bunch of other perks to do with the content we make. So go check it out. So just before we get started, we wanted to just remind you about this really exciting thing that we have going on, the Joachim Trier Challenge. So at the moment, we are working on an ebook about the films of Joachim Trier. He is a Norwegian filmmaker who has just released his latest feature, The Worst Person in the World, which is Oscar nominated. And
twice
Oscar nominated. And we're huge fans of his work. We have been for like a decade now. He also made Oslo, August 31st, Louder Than Bombs, Reprise, and Thelma. And we realize that although there's a lot of hype around his recent film, not everyone's like super familiar with his past work, and we discuss it a lot in our ebook, which is called Existential Detours: Joachim Trier's Cinema of Indecisions and Revisions. And you can find out more about that at existentialdetours.com. But that book's out in the summer, and we wanted to create a way for you to sort of engage with Trier's work and become familiar with it and think about it in the lead up to that book, which features like interviews with him and all his collaborators and essays on all the film, and it's really like a deep dive into his work. So in the run-up, we've created the Joachim Trier Challenge. Starting this week, actually, is our first week. So we started this Monday the 14th. And to this week, we are focusing on his first film, Reprise. The next week, it will be Oslo, August 31st, his second film. The week after, Louder Than Bombs, his third film. And the week after, the final week, Thelma, his fourth film. And each week, we will send you an email all about like how to watch the film, context for the film, what this film is, excerpts from our discussion of the film in the ebook, further reading, further viewing. And we'd basically just be like set up to understand the film. And then we also offer a premium version of the challenge, which is all that, plus you get an audio commentary on each film recorded by myself and Alex, which is pretty significant, I think, because he doesn't actually record audio commentaries for his own film, so like hasn't thus far. We, having interviewed him and his collaborators, are trying to provide that insight in our own audio commentaries. And we also will invite you to a Zoom discussion meeting at the end of the 4 weeks, so you can chat with us and a bunch of the other people who are taking the premium challenge to like discuss what you've seen and talk it through, mull it over. And you can do that on our like private online forum for the people who are taking the challenge as well throughout the challenge. So basically the premium version is like everything that the free version allows, plus the audio commentaries, plus a sense of like communal viewing experience. So you can go to existentialdetours.com/challenge to find out more about that. And it will also be in the show notes of this episode.
Most of the films that we watched at Berlin were from the sidebars. Having gone in person this year, the competition publicists were very, very stingy about sharing titles.
Last year, we did the entire festival virtually and they offered everything. And so we did get to like really have a taste of what Berlin is like, and we loved it. We thought like we've become like Berlin evangelists.
Yes.
Because their programming is so excellent. And unlike a lot of festivals, like as great as the sidebar films are, the competition films are also fantastic. I think a lot of festivals, the competition films are in the competition because they have famous people in them.
Yeah, or they're friends of the festival, or there's some sort of like inside deals going on, like why is Sean Penn in the Cannes competition when his films suck?
Because he's Sean Penn.
Yeah.
But I think Berlin has a bit more integrity in the fact that I think, yeah, like, but based on last year at least, a lot of the films in the competition were just like some of the best films at the festival, and it seemed that they had been like very carefully selected to be the competition films for that reason. But the quality of programming throughout the whole program was excellent as well.
Yeah, and I think Berlin has a history of programming a lot of the best films of the year, like some of the films that were at the festival that have been on our best of lists. Andrew Haig's 45 Years premiered there. Agnieszka Holland's Charlatan premiered there. Mia Hansen Love's Things to Come.
A lot of our list of the best of last year.
Yes.
Berlin.
A huge chunk of our list last year, including Charlatan. Yeah. Had like several years of Berlin Film Festival titles there.
Exactly. It was Charlatan, I'm Your Man, Petite Maman.
Ninja Baby. Oh, no, that wasn't there yet.
No, Wheel of Fortune and Fantasy is just outside the top 10.
Was Bad Luck banging on our top 10?
It was not top 10, it was about 15-ish. I mean, that's an impressive hit rate.
Yeah.
And there were a bunch of films that just like hadn't come out yet, like I think Mr. Bachman and His Class.
Yeah.
Like will come out this year, and that will probably be on our list because it's excellent. And Ninja Baby, like you said, and all sorts of films. Yeah, so Berlin. They're pretty good at programming. I think for, even if there were less films that we loved this year, because we also were restricted in like not being able to see all of the films, and we also spent a little less dedicated time to watching them because we weren't accredited press, even though we did watch a lot of films. But the hit rate of like really well-made, interesting films was really impressive, especially compared to like Sundance.
And I'm sure, like, if we had seen the competition films and we made a top 20 list, many of these would be on that list. Because even last year, many sidebar films were on our list. Like, Brother's Keeper was fantastic. That was in the Panorama section and is still seeking a distributor. Miguel's War, Ninja Baby. Those are sort of, like, some of the major highlights of the sidebars. And then there were even more that I caught up with, like, later after Berlin. Like, Wood and Water, which was wonderful. If I'd seen that at Berlin, it would have been on our list.
North by Current,
yeah. So yeah, just generally really strong programming. Whereas I feel like our experience with Sundance, I mean, Berlin is always fun to do on the heels of Sundance because you come out of Sundance like, I've lost hope in cinema. American movies are so samey. Everything's a 3-star film. Is anybody going to ever do anything interesting with cinema? And then you go to like Berlin and you're like, I'm traveling around the world and none of these films are boring. And yeah. None of these films are bad.
And they're actually, it's interesting because there is a bit of crossover programming between Sundance and Berlin. So the films that I saw at Sundance at Berlin were...
We deliberately saw a lot of the films that were at Berlin.
Yeah.
And we knew
were, because we were like, Berlin, if they programmed it, then it might actually be good.
And I think generally that was true. A lot of the better films were...
I think the one exception was Brainwash, Sex, Camera, Power, which we did not like.
No, we did
at
not.
Sundance. But like... There were some, like, films at Sundance that, you know, I didn't love but were entertaining or interesting in their own way. Like, Cool Jane, A Love Song, And good luck to you, Leo Grand.
We're all right, I forgot that
crossovers.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they're all, you know, some of the films that, like, I actually did find some value in at Sundance, even if they weren't, like, among the very best. And then Girl Picture is the main one that, like, I think, for me, does stand amongst, like, the quality of the Berlin films we've been watching over the last couple of weeks. Because even though it is messy, I think it's definitely a film that stuck with me.
Yeah,
but I think it's really well made, really well acted.
It's a flawed film with a lot of staying power. Like, yes. I think I like it a lot more now than I did a month ago when I was kind of like, you know, you're watching, you're aware of the flaws, but then the fact that it stuck with you, it's like, yeah, okay, it's flawed, but you know what? It was doing something really interesting and important.
Yeah, and actually, of all those films I mentioned, it's the only one not in English, so.
Right. Well, and by contrast, of course, right, like the, I mean, we watched pretty much all the World Dramatic titles at Sundance between the two of us, and did we like any of the others?
That was, Girl Picture was by far the best.
By far the best. The rest were
like, wasn't really a competition.
Somewhere like okay, boring, bad. I think okay was kind of the best that I saw. Point is, Berlin has better programming. And one of the things we love about Berlin, and is we're going to be talking about a lot because a lot of our favorites of the ones we watched were in this section, is the generation section. And we talked about this a bit last year, but Berlin, because it is a people's film festival, like it is for the public.
Like it's actually a people's film festival. They don't just call it that.
So they actually program films that they think people might want to see.
Radical, I know.
And in particular, what I think they do that's really good is they're trying to bring in young audiences, because most film festivals, even if they are public, like TIFF and Sundance, like maybe they'll have one or two films where they're like, you could maybe take your kids to this.
Mm-hmm. I don't even really look at the kids section at like LFF or Sundance or whatever, because I'm like, there's like three films in there and they're not going to be of interest
probably. To be fair, sometimes they've had good things. They had Shaun the Sheep at Sundance. They've had The Big Bad Fox and Other Tales at TIFF, and Ernest and Celestine was at Sundance, I think. I'm trying to remember. But like, there have been good things, but there's also bad things. But also their idea of kids is like five-year-olds. And what Generation does, I mean, the Generation does have some films that are definitely intended for like five-year-olds or kids under 10. But they also do a lot of stuff that's trying to program for teenagers. And I think that's so fantastic, because if you want to have an audience for your festival in 10 years or 20 years, you need to have new cinephiles. And a good way to do that is to program films about young people for young people, not just hoping that they'll all watch... Well, not even a boring movie, like hoping they'll watch Drive My Car and get something. But like, they're kind of too young for that.
Yeah. like there's expected to be a leap from children's cinema being like very young people cinema to straight to adult cinema.
Yeah.
That just like happens to like have a 12 certificate or something.
Yeah.
And that's not how it works. And I've never really seen a festival that goes out of its way to like program for specific age brackets like that, and but also to not like talk down to those age brackets with the programming. There's some genuinely challenging material in all of the generation sections. There's like one for like, was it like under 13 and over 13?
Under 12 and over 12, but
and they are very interested in challenging those audiences, but like while also entertaining them and like providing films that are actually good, because that's how you get people interested in cinema. And it's like cultivating like an audience for their film festival in 10 years, but also like a generation of young viewers who are like interested in really engaging with cinematic storytelling rather than just sort of like seeing films as like a piece of entertainment that they like go to the cinema twice a year.
Yeah.
And that's like to see a blockbuster.
My favorite film, I think, of what I watched was a generation title that actually ended up winning the prize.
Which was it? Was it over 13 or,
I think
or
it was
over
under 12? I think this was the under 12 prize, which I was sort of surprised by, because I would have thought it was maybe for an older audience, but...
I mean, but the character is... How old is she? Like, she's around 13-ish.
Yeah, I guess. That's true.
What do you know what won the over 12
yeah,
prize?
It was Alice? Or Alice?
Yeah. I didn't see that.
Which is sort of a documentary. And it's set in Bogota. They get 10 young women to come in, close their eyes, and pretend they have an imaginary friend named Alice. And... to bring their story to life through these interviews.
I mean, that sounds to me like a very like creative nonfiction film.
Yeah.
One thing I will say about Berlin, and it's true of like the documentaries I did watch at the festival, is you're pretty much guaranteed to for the documentaries to be playing with form in some interesting way. If you watch a documentary at Berlin, which is like so not the case with like most film festivals, and that's really exciting. I mean, I'll talk about some of those later.
They also don't totally separate the documentaries from into a separate program. Like there is a documentary program which is a bit more experimental, and that's the forum section, which is a bit more experimental or avant-garde. But then documentaries are spread out across all of the sections in the panorama section, the generation section, the encounters, which is sort of more, I don't even know if avant-garde is the right thing, but it's sort of like, I don't know, director-driven, whatever the hell that means. And also in the competition, like they're spread out. It's not like at Sundance where if you just don't look at the documentary categories, you'll never see them. Or at TIFF, if you ignore TIFF docs, like, you can pretty much 99% avoid the documentaries. There might be, like, one or two in contemporary world cinema or discovery. But Berlin, I like that they program them alongside everything else. It doesn't treat them as somehow lesser or deserving to be siphoned off. So Comedy Queen, it's a Swedish film. And it's, like, there seems to be this thing going on in Scandinavia / Nordic countries where they're starting to make films about young people dealing with parents with mental health issues. There was a really wonderful Finnish film called Little Wing that was at TIFF a few years ago that dealt with, I think, like a parent with schizophrenia. It disappeared after that, but it was a really wonderful film. And then this kind of made me think of that because this is another film about a young girl. She's 13 years old, and when we meet her, she is dealing with the grief from her mother's death, who died by suicide and had been struggling with depression for years. And of course, being a 13-year-old, she does not know how to deal with this. And her solution, she makes a list of things that she's, you know, like if she accomplishes these things, then she won't end up like her mother and things will be okay. And she's like, well, my mother read a lot of books, so I'm never going to read a book again.
My mother had long, beautiful hair, so I'm going to shave all my hair.
Yes.
You know, the things that lead to depression.
Yes.
And she said that her mother, like, looked after a living being, which was her, and it didn't make her happy. So she's never going to look after a living thing, and which becomes a problem when her dad gets her the puppy she's always wanted for her birthday.
And then the film gets its title because she's sad that her father never smiles, and she often hears him like wailing in the other room next door because he's very sad. And so she's like, well, things aren't going to get better unless I can make him laugh, so I need to become a great stand-up comedian to make my father laugh. I mean, obviously she eventually discovers that these are not like the keys to happiness, but along the way sort of gains some confidence and starts to grow into herself, I guess.
She's like a character who is very infectious because she is like really intent and driven towards like having a positive mindset.
Yes.
And she's struggling to do that, obviously, because she's dealing with grief and her father's depression and everything, but she's incredibly driven towards this goal of being happy, and failing to understand like how a person becomes happy.
Yeah. Well, and what's really wonderful is it's not a film where it's like she's just left out to dry while her father spirals into depression. Like, he is genuinely a good father who's caring for her, and he takes her to therapy, and he wants to try and talk about their feelings. And I guess the other thing is she refuses to cry because she's like, my mom cried all the time and now she's dead.
So she'll go like and lie on the floor so that her tears will like go back into her eyes.
Yeah.
If she thinks she's about to cry.
But yeah, I guess what I really love is the fact that, like, here is somebody who's trying and yet they still can't communicate with each other. Just very, like, louder than bombs kind of reminded me of that a bit. And so it's a really lovely story, and it's not like her father is a bad parent or has toxic masculinity. He's actually, like, a gentle soul and a caring person. It's just that this is how do you talk about the grief of somebody dying by suicide way too young? And the thing is, nobody really knows how to do that.
And it's a film that will, like, there's several scenes at the end that will just have you, like, happy crying.
Yeah.
Intensely.
And it's quite funny, too.
Yeah.
Not just because some of her jokes are good, but just because it's like, the tone of the film is very light.
It's funny because some of her jokes are good, and then also because some of her jokes are not good.
Yes. I do like her joke, though, when she says that if she's wondering if her outfit's good, she asks her father, and if he says yes, then she knows that it's terrible.
Well, I'd say that my favorite film was this Spanish film called Lullaby, which stars Lea Acosta, who is an actress who I don't think I really knew what I thought of her until I watched this film. Like, me and Alex have discussed, I was looking through the films she's made, and I've seen several of them and I've liked none of them. In fact, a lot of them I've thought were actively bad. And it's never been that she's been bad in them, but because I've disliked the films and the way her characters were written so much, I've not been able to, like, gain any enthusiasm for her as an actress.
Yeah, like, she got her start in Victoria, which did no favors for anyone. I was surprised to learn that Franz Rogowski was really good after that film, because that film was so bad.
And Only You was just a bit of a catastrophe, but, like, her character is also, like, makes no sense. Like, it's so difficult to believe anything in that film.
Definitely Harry Wolff's fault, based on how she writes her female characters in her subsequent film.
Then I have seen Drake Doremus's Newness.
Oh, wow, okay. Deep cut.
Yeah, not good. I mean, that should be self-explanatory. It's directed by Drake Doremus, but suffice to say, she hasn't had a good run. But now I have an opinion on her. I think she's really fantastic in this film. Like, really fantastic.
Yeah.
It's a film that, like, deals so, so well with, like, the emotional labor placed on the female partner after giving birth, and, like, how the small expectations on her pile up, and the things that are unsaid that are, like, so often not dealt with in films at all, or not dealt with well. Like, this is a whole film about, like, gendered labor, and it's not a film that's, like, super plot heavy, and it's basically kind of, like, deals with two locations and, like, the area around one of those locations. She's like, at the very beginning of the film, Lea Acosta has just come home with her newborn daughter, and she's with her partner, and her parents have, like, come to help them settle back home. And then as soon as her parents leave, or, like, shortly after, she's, like, a freelancer, and she's decided to sort of take a month off of working. And then her partner says to her, oh, hey, I've just got a call about, like, a job that, like, requires me to move away for 3 months, and I, like, really want to do it, but, like, if you don't want me to do it, then that's fine. And she's like, I don't want you to do it, I want you here to help with the baby. And he's like, okay, I mean, if you don't want me to do it. And then, like, an hour later, he's like, you know, I really want to do that job because, you know, we should, like, make money because, you know, we have, like, a daughter now. And eventually she's just like, okay, fine then, go do what you want. She has to start working again, and she cannot do it looking after this baby. She's, like, completely frazzled. And so she decides to take herself and her child to go back and live with her parents, who live in a more sort of, like, countrysidey, seaside part of Spain. I mean, the film is just sort of observing the dynamics between her and her mother, and her mother and her father, and the way that the gendered labor that has been placed on her mother by her father throughout her whole life is now, like, those dynamics are being replicated with Leah Costa's character and her husband. And it's a really just thoughtful look at like generations of women and how they're affected by like the subtle pervasive misogyny and like expectations placed on women to like do certain aspects of housework or looking after children and to just be on top of everything for their partner and to have all the paperwork done and to have all the logistics sorted and to have everything in order so that the other person doesn't have to think about it because they aren't going to think about it. Yeah. And it's all these things that are like silent things in society that the film very quietly and with a lot of nuance brings to the forefront of quite a simple narrative. And I just thought it was so wonderful at doing that.
My short explainer of often what it's like to work with or deal with men is like, men are like, well, if you told me to do the thing, I would have done it. And women are like, well, I figured out that the thing needed to be done and I did it and I didn't even ask you about it or tell you about it because I did it already. And this is a feature length film of the men basically not pulling their weight. And then if they're asked to pull their weight, they're like, oh, you mean you wanted me to do that? It's like, yeah, dude.
It's like we talk a lot about how like films can be really useful as like a language to describe an experience that might be hard to explain. Like what you just explained is often so hard to explain to people in a way that they're going to understand, especially if they haven't been through it. So now I'm very grateful that we have this film to show to people and be like, well, that's what I mean. Watch this film. Watch how like all those little things have like built up throughout the mother's life and affected her massively.
There's also this horrifying scene near the end where, because the mother is terminally ill by midway through the film and Leah Costa's character is caring for her. And near the end, her mother basically says to her, your father has been my burden throughout my life. And when I die, he'll be your burden. By which she means like feeding him, clothing him, making sure he can survive is suddenly now her daughter's problem, even though he's a grown man who should be able to take care of himself.
I mean, it's a heartbreaking scene. I just think it's around when you're talking about where, like, her mother, like, shows her all the paperwork she's done to, like, sort out what's going to happen after she dies and what's going to happen to her father as well.
Yeah.
And you think that, oh, okay, so, like, you couldn't trust your husband to, like, make sure that everything was running smoothly. So you've got to, like, pass that on to your daughter, who you can actually trust to do all the little things that need to get done. You know that your husband is going to be sort of like an emotional wreck who is just going to sort of shut down. And you know that your daughter is programmed to be in like
not
action doing mode. Yeah, to like to not be able to sort of sit in her emotions for too long and to actually have to do the work of making sure everything's okay for everyone around her. And so you know that she'll be able to do that even though she'll be grieving her mother. And it's just one of like many like great little touches in the film that is like really quite sad at the end because of the way that it thinks about those things.
My Small Land, which is directed by Aima Kawawada, who is a protege of Kurita, and you can definitely see that in the film that she is influenced by him. But it's a very interesting story because it is set in Japan, but it's the story of a Kurdish refugee, Saria, who is 17 and who has been in Japan most of her life. She speaks Japanese fluently. And as a Kurd, she doesn't really have a homeland. You know, like she was born in Turkey, but she doesn't remember it. And you know, the Kurds were colonized and basically, you know, the land where they lived was divided up into other countries. And so, like, there is no Kurdish territory, per se. And she also doesn't really have a connection to Turkey because she doesn't remember it. She's, you know, she's starting to think about college. She wants to be a teacher. And she is saving up money to do this. She's secretly got a part-time job where she meets a boy that she falls in love with. But very close to the beginning of the film, they get informed that their application for refugee status has been denied, and that means that their visas, I don't know if they're like canceled or they're on hold, but mm-hmm. basically it means that like they can stay in Japan where they in the sort of suburb of Tokyo where they are, but they're not allowed to leave the city. And they're not allowed to work and earn money. And
which makes it impossible to stay.
Well, of course, yes, because you do actually need to earn money to do things like pay rent and eat. Yes. And Saria, her job is in Tokyo, not in the town where she lives. And so to go there would be to break the rules twice. And of course, her father is going to have to do something to earn money, which is breaking the rules. And they get informed by their lawyer at the beginning that they should, you know, follow the rules, don't break them, because the consequences of breaking them could be dire. But they're in this impossible situation if they don't break them. Basically, you know, all of the things that you think might happen would happen, I guess. And suddenly all of the responsibility is on her shoulders. And she is a 17-year-old and she has two younger siblings that suddenly are her job to take care of. She's in school. She doesn't have an income. How is she going to keep paying rent, take care of these children, and will she have a future? And her father kind of abandons her.
I mean, it's just a really sort of sensitively told character drama and so good at, like what you said, like the impossible situation they're in. It's so good at showing the impossibility of a situation that like so many refugees are put in.
Mm.
Her father is in a situation where if he were to be deported, he would be arrested as soon as he got back to Turkey.
Yeah, and that would mean he would get killed.
Right, so what's what better option do they have?
Yeah.
You know, it's a kind of story that I haven't, like I've seen refugee stories, although not in this particular locale.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit of a shaggy film at 2 hours, but I think purposefully so, because what it does is it gives us a lot of time to watch the protagonist thinking and making decisions. Like, as she says at the beginning that their lives are very restricted, is how she describes it when she tells her boyfriend what's going on with their visa situation. And mm-hmm. what the film does really well is it lets us see the agency she does have. Within the very limited and bad choices that are available to her, you get to see her making choices. And I think that's pretty rare generally. Like even in a story, especially in a story about somebody whose life is already restricted, it's usually the story is just about the restrictions, not about the choices within it.
Mm-hmm.
Even if they're all crappy choices. And it's especially rare, I think, for a story about a young person where you get to see them making lots of choices instead of just looking at, you know, what a horrible situation she's in. What happens to her is unfair, but she's not just sitting there having horrible things happen to her. She's doing her best. And the ways in which she tries and is not able to try are sort of what define her and give her agency. And also about her sort of assimilation process and how it's impossible for her to assimilate if she wants to in Japan. Like, even though she speaks the language, she probably identifies with the culture more than she does with, like, being a Kurd to a degree. By virtue of her skin tone and her hair, like, everybody immediately sees her as a foreigner.
But she also tells them that she's German.
Right, because she doesn't want to be perceived as Turkish or Kurdish, which has some negative...
Well, to explain her identity as a Kurd is also so complicated.
Yeah.
And it's something that she doesn't want to, like... Because, I mean, like you explained, there's, like, an extra placelessness to that than if you were to just be a refugee from one country to another or to move from one country to another. She does explain it to her boyfriend later in the film, but... He hasn't even, like, heard of Kurds, and she wants sort of the simplicity of just being, like, German rather than having this really complicated identity that, like, makes her feel rootless, like, in any place. To talk about a couple of the other films, I actually think that there's a good double bill here of, like, how about we feel incredibly stressed all the time with Until Tomorrow and Millie Lies Low are like the high blood pressure films of the festival.
Oh my goodness.
Until Tomorrow is, I mean, it's also kind of a good double bill with Lullaby, and then it's like, I have a baby, what the fuck do I do with it?
We need a letterboxed list of that, of films that are like, I have a baby, what the fuck do I do with it?
Yeah, so I was interested in this film because it's directed by Ali Asghari, who I've not seen a lot of his work, but he has worked a lot with Farnoosh Samedi, I think, who was the director of 180 Degree Rule, which is a film I liked a lot, and she like co-writes a lot with him. And I've seen a short film that they made together. So I was like sort of aware of his work. And then the lead actress, Sadaf Asghari, who is like a... I've actually ended up seeing like basically most of the things that she's made to date. She's a young Iranian actress and she's very compelling. And I first saw her in this short film called Exam, which is really fantastic. I've seen a couple of things she's been in. So I was excited to watch this. And it's basically about, she plays a young mother living in Tehran, and at the beginning of the film she finds out that her parents are unexpectedly coming to stay at her apartment, and they don't know about her child. Her child is illegitimate, and she's trying to hide the existence of the child from them. One must question how this cannot last very long, because eventually the child is going to grow into a bigger child, but she's rightly so afraid of the consequences of her parents finding this out, and is terrified and trying to postpone that. And so she thinks, there must be a way for me to like have a friend look after my child. That can't be that complicated, right? It turns out, like, we basically go on a wild goose chase through the city over a couple of hours, and she's helped out by her friend, and a series of events unfolds that are increasingly stressful. And it turns out it actually is quite difficult to find someone to look after your baby for a night. Mm-hmm. And we encounter a lot of bureaucratic obstacles that just sort of like unfold the ways in which she, like, as a woman with an illegitimate child, is not afforded as much freedom as she should be, and is open for exploitation by people when she's in this vulnerable situation. I found it very compelling. It's an entertaining film, and the fact that you're gripped by it throughout.
But it's sort of real time, like she's racing against the clock. She has, I don't know, 6 hours to find somebody to take care of her kid.
Yeah, and you're just sort of like hiding your eyes like, oh god, no, this can't get worse, can it? And then it does. And it's like it's a series of like obstacles that she faces, where by the end you're sort of weighing up what's worse, like facing the sort of social consequences of her parents reacting to this illegitimate baby, versus like dealing with like the mess she's now in for trying to find help. And yeah, so I like that one quite a bit. Again, I would compare it to Millie Lies Low, which is a New Zealand film.
I mean, thank goodness Millie isn't a parent.
Yeah, it's about a woman who is a bit of a mess, called Millie. And it opens with her on a flight to New York, which is about to take off. And she's having a panic attack.
From New Zealand.
And she's having a panic attack and she leaves, but then she cannot face up to the consequences of her actions. So she decides that she's going to pretend. She's going to try and get the next flight out of New Zealand to New York. And she is going to, meanwhile on her Instagram, pretend that she's in New York, not tell anyone, and then try to find a way to afford the plane ticket to New York in the 2 days in between her flight.
Somehow she didn't know that it costs thousands of dollars to fly from New Zealand to New York.
Yeah, and like in Until Tomorrow, although in quite a different context, the consequences of her actions pile up and up and up.
Yeah.
In a way that she is not prepared for.
And in her case, it's her own fault. Like, she just digs a bigger and bigger hole for herself. It's not like Te Farda or Until Tomorrow, where you're, like, the whole system is against her. Like, Millie could have solved her problem fairly easily and chooses not to, because she has too much self-loathing and insecurity. And
it's like a horror story about what happens when you are too afraid to communicate and face up to your problems.
Oh my goodness.
And
it's
she
so stressful.
Yeah. And she's basically on her way to New York because she's gotten this amazing opportunity. She's an architecture student, and she's got this amazing opportunity to like go and study in New York. She's been picked out of her whole class as the most exceptional student, and it's quite funny when she's in like the airport after running off the plane, there's like a big ad about like on her face, like advertising the school that she went to.
Yeah.
And she's like in her hoodie, like with her head down.
Yeah, everywhere she goes. She goes to like a grocery store, there's a magazine with her face on the cover of it. She's like the most conspicuous person trying to be inconspicuous.
Yeah. And it was when she goes into like a party where her like all her old friends are in like what she wears like a motorcycle helmet, and she just walks around and like eavesdrops some people talking about her. So she's meant to go to this thing, and at first you're sort of like, oh, this is like an imposter syndrome movie where she feels like she, you know, she doesn't deserve this opportunity. But then you find out pretty quickly that like she actually doesn't deserve this opportunity. Like, and that's what I was like, oh, this movie's doing something a little bit different, because she's in this motorcycle helmet and she listens to her friends talking, and one of her friends who is a really talented architect, and you get the impression from what they're saying that Millie has just kind of like copied off her. She's a reputation for just like kind of copying off her friend, and for like jumping on other people's ideas and not really knowing what like she thinks about things or what she wants, and just, which, you know, and I've known people like that, and it turns out she's one of those people.
There's a very funny scene at one, I can't remember if this is before the party, she goes to her architecture school to hide out, and she gets caught by the security guard and told to go away, but she's standing in front of the like final project that she made and that her best friend made, and the security guard is like, oh, is that yours? And she pretends that yes, the one that her best friend made is hers, and the security guard goes, oh wow, look, that one beside it is so derivative, like that person obviously copied you. And she's like, are you sure it wasn't the other way around? And then of course we realize as the film goes on that, like, first it's played as, you know, kind of a joke that the security guard is saying this, and she's saying this just because she thinks that the non-derivative one is Millie's, and does she actually know anything about architecture? But, you know, as it goes on, it becomes clear that the security guard nailed it.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a film about, like, you just have to learn to believe in yourself. It's a film about how, like, maybe in some cases the imposter syndrome is correct, and you need to take a really, like, good look at your life and, like, how you've lived it and what you really want and what you're really good at, and not tie that to other people. And Millie has been really bad at that, and now that she's having to make such a huge life change, her panic attack is trying to tell her something, and it's about the real struggle to get her to face up to that and all the like horribly embarrassing things that happen along the way.
I think I liked the film a lot less than you did. And my issue with it was, like, I agree with you on all these things. I think it does all this well. But I guess my feeling is I didn't really get a strong enough read on her psychologically. Like, I don't really understand why she did this. And I didn't really understand at the beginning. And I don't really feel like I understood toward the end.
Like, I guess I don't really understand. I understand what Millie shouldn't be doing, and less about what she wants to be doing, and that might be because she also like just hasn't thought about it and she needs to start from the bottom up. But I think that the film could do a better job of like giving us the fullness of like what she, like what kind of person she might want to start to be,
or why is it that she has, why has she spent her life clinging to other people's aspirations, why has she failed to define herself, and obviously there's a universal thing of that. That's a scary thing to do, and you can understand that. But, like, specifically for her, it's not really dealt with. And there's some things in it that are also sort of left hanging. Like, the actress is Maori. She's actually starred in the Netflix film Cousins, which Array Now released. And
her mother is played by Rachel House.
Yeah, who is a very famous Maori actor in New Zealand.
Yeah, I feel like every time I watch a New Zealand film, I'm like, oh, look, there's Rachel House.
Yeah, and she's sometimes in Australian films too. But it doesn't really deal with her identity at all. Like, there's something interesting that she grew up in the Philippines because her parents were missionaries, and now now her mother is culturally appropriating things from the Philippines, and they wanted her to grow up in New Zealand so that she could have some connection to her Maori heritage. But like, it's all very undercooked and underexplored. And I looked it up, and I think that the woman who directed it and wrote it is a settler white lady. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I wanted a bit more of that too. Like, I wanted, it was interesting that all that was in there, but then I wasn't really sure exactly what it was saying with it.
Yeah.
And I was a bit frustrated with that because you could find something interesting to say with all that material, but it felt like, I don't know, maybe the director didn't want to like fully go there.
Yeah. But I mean, the lead actress is wonderful. I'm excited to see her in other things.
I realized I had seen her in also a Netflix film, The Breaker Upper is.
Oh, I didn't know she was in that too.
Yeah, and she's like a supporting part in that. And yeah, she's really fantastic in it. Her name is Anna Scottney.
So I'll just talk really briefly about Stay Awake, which I think got the runner-up for the Generation 12 Plus prize. It's just like a very good double feature to do with Comedy Queen. I mean, this is about two teenage boys. One is like 17, the other maybe he's not even a teenager anymore, he's like 19 or 20, and they have a single mother and their mother is suicidal. And at the beginning of the film you see them like in the car driving her to the hospital singing show tunes to keep her awake because she's OD'd, and you understand very quickly that they have done this many, many, many times.
And this is an American film.
It's an American film. And it's a story of them trying to figure out how to have independent lives when they have spent their lives caring for their mother who can't bother to care for herself, and how hard it is. Like, they've sent her to rehab several times and, you know, spent all of their money from their part-time jobs doing this. And then she comes back and she does this again. It's really from their perspective. You see how hard it is for them to sort of eventually, like, what are they supposed to do, basically? You know, like, are you supposed to let your mother kill herself? On the other hand, you're the child, not the parent. It shouldn't be your job to keep your mother alive. And eventually you can't make it your job or you're not going to have a life. There are things in it that are not perfect or great. And there's like some underdeveloped queer stuff going on. But I thought it was a really thoughtful look at that. And I'd like to see more stories about that, because I think dealing with a parent who can't parent is a pretty common issue. Maybe not necessarily because they're suicidal, but we don't have a lot of stories about it. And I think more of them is great.
Yeah.
The other one I wanted to mention is Coma, which is Bertrand Bonello's new film. I like don't even know how to describe this film. It is so weird. It's like a love letter to his daughter. It's like, I don't know, is this fiction or creative nonfiction? Because it's like maybe somewhere in between them. It's like Bertrand Bonello shows like zoomed in images from his film Nocturama. And he's reading a letter to his daughter in voiceover over these images at the beginning, talking about like telling her about this film. And then the majority of the film is about his daughter's life under lockdown and the weird sort of limbo space that she ends up occupying. Like, I don't always think it's necessarily the most thoughtful film about this, but I do think it really evokes nicely the way that you're like still living your life, but you're in a kind of like alternate universe. And you keep seeing her going into this sort of like forested area, which is some kind of, is it in her dreams or is it on the internet? And it's this weird sort of physical limbo of where she's going and living her life. And then there's like weird stuff in there too. Like, she has a little diorama with like a Ken and Barbie doll, and the Ken and Barbie doll get vaguely animated and are talking about how like Ken is having an affair on the Barbie doll. And this is like some imagining, this is all inside her bedroom. And And then the film gets its title because she obsessively watches this YouTube channel from a social media influencer whose last name is Coma. And this woman is a piece of work as well. And if you want to see a social media influencer put her hand in a blender because it's the pandemic, this is the movie for you.
I can't say that's ever something that I've thought that I wanted to see.
It's like, I don't know, it's a movie that I feel like has, it's rich for discussion. I don't know that it always works. It's a bit of a exhausting watch. Like, it's 90 minutes, but it felt longer. But it's definitely stuck with me, which I think is always a good sign. And it's trying to do something interesting with what is it like, what is the headspace of being in a sort of lockdown? What is that? Like, your life is still going on, but not in the way that it used to. And, oh, and I guess the one other one, which I should mention, is We Might As Well Be Dead, which I think was in the Dutch Kino section, which is like German films and has had a lot of good films in it over the years. It's like the graduation film of Natalia Sinelnikova is the director, and it's her graduation film from film school. And it's this sort of dissection of like a fascist mentality, which I think we can all identify with as a world where we've decided everybody can just die because wearing a piece of cloth on your face is too much. But so it takes place in this sort of dystopian future where at the beginning we see this family like holding hands, walking through a forest, going up to this apartment block for an interview to go live in this apartment. And they're super, super, super desperate. And then we see this like board who run the apartment deciding, you know, do you want them as a neighbor? And we discover that this is some sort of seeming safe utopia, this apartment block outside of, we don't really ever find out what happens in the outside world, but it seems like you're basically lambs for the slaughter. And then it mostly follows the woman who works as the security guard in this building, and she is an immigrant. I can't remember from where. And so people get kind of xenophobic about her. And then a few things happen, like her dog goes missing, and then somebody gets something stolen from them. And then like the whole apartment complex becomes super, super paranoid, and they start trying to point fingers at people. And we find out that it's really ruthless about like forcing people out of the building. Like, if you break a rule, then you'll be locked out of the building for the night and you'll just have to like sleep outside. They'll give you a blanket. And there's a scene where that happens to her. And then we see her like dealing with her frostbitten feet the next day. And everyone just treats this shit as normal. And then they decide that everybody's who hasn't been living there for at least 10 years is going to have to reapply to live in this building. And so then this becomes like people are like, how do I ingratiate myself with my neighbors? And then people are kind of like forming a mob. And it's this nice sort of little allegory for basically a fascist state.
And to close us out, let's talk a bit about like the documentaries, the creative nonfiction films that we really liked at the festival. Because I think there's a couple really significant ones that we want to bring to the table. Like, for example, I saw this documentary, Nelly and Nadine, which is a Swedish film. Another Swedish film, Sweden doing well at the festival. And it's a documentary, so it's essentially about like looking back at, well, we follow this woman who's now, you know, in her 60s, 70s, who is the granddaughter of this woman called Nelly, who was in the concentration camps. And this woman that we're following, the granddaughter, is basically like through the making of the film, rediscovering the life of her grandmother. The film opens with I believe it's the director's voiceover as he is looking through this archive footage of people like just off the boats away from the camps. It's this amazingly restored footage. I don't know like how they achieved that. It's so crisp and like so like uncanny to watch this footage in such like high definition. And he's sort of slowly looking over the faces and zooming in on people's faces who like catch his eye, and describing the research he's done into their lives, like how he like use this footage to try to find out who they were. And then he zooms in this one woman, this, I think she's a Chinese woman called Nadine. And then I'm not totally sure how he came to this subject, whether it was through the footage and then finding Nellie's granddaughter through that. But Nadine,
it was, he'd made two other films about concentration camps. Uh-huh. And she was in those films. And when he had toured with those films, somebody called him and said, like, I know that person and this is their granddaughter, and I put them in touch.
So we start with this footage of Nadine, Nadine's still face in this still footage. Then we meet Nellie's granddaughter and realize that Nellie and Nadine met in the concentration camps and fell in love and were separated briefly, but then when they both survived, met up again and then lived together for decades until Nadine died. And Nellie's granddaughter is aware of Nadine because she would, I mean, she lived with her grandmother, but only, like, she interpreted as a young person, their relationship is just like the person that my grandmother lives with. And it's not until this film where the director sort of confronts her with this, or like she is rediscovering like old photographs, old footage, this archive of Nellie and Nadine's life, that we basically, I feel like the film is chronicling her emotional reaction to reconsidering these memories that she hadn't really thought about, and the emotional experience of like realizing that this really important history in her family was like lost even to her, and all the lost years of not understanding what had happened and not understanding while her grandmother was still alive either. And it's such an emotional film, I think, because it knows that the right way to tell this story is to follow like the journey of processing that in the granddaughter, and the way that like her initial reaction differs from then as she's going through this process of learning more and then talking to her sister about it and just finding out as much as she can. And so it's, I think it's quite a beautiful story. And I think, you know, like it's, we can say about like creative nonfiction doesn't necessarily have to be this like incredibly like explosively formally inventive thing. It can just be about like finding the right emotional way into the story that isn't necessarily the just purely facts-based way into a story. And this film does that like really wonderfully.
I guess the film that I saw, which you saw part of, is Mutzenbacher.
It's an Austrian film, right? It's not German.
Yeah, yeah. It's an Austrian film in the Encounters section. And basically the premise is it's named after this lead, the protagonist, the like 13-year-old protagonist of this pornographic novel that was popular in the 1910s or 1920s. And the director basically has this open casting session where she invites men, I think it's like age 16 to 99, to come in and read bits of the novel and then respond to it. It's a film that is like, what if we give men to rope to hang themselves? How long will it take for them to hang themselves?
And the answer is not very long.
Not very long. Like 90% of them hang themselves pretty quickly. Like the guy who starts out sounding reasonable and then apropos of nothing wants to tell you about this time that he did a nude photography shoot and then fucked the woman that he was doing this for and her like 16-year-old daughter.
I did watch that bit and I was like, can you say this and not like get arrested?
I know, right? And then there is the other guy who reads a scene about a father raping his 12-year-old daughter. And this guy's conclusion is nice, hot, natural. And then we find out that, like, he wanted to fuck his mother. So I guess that's why he thinks this is okay, even though the power dynamics are totally different. And then, of course, like, there are some, a couple of young boys who say thoughtful things. There's a very funny scene where this like 16 or 17-year-old boy is talking about how great masturbation is. And he's something like, you can massage yourself into an ecstasy of happiness. Something like that is how he describes it, which is quite funny. And it's like, and his friend who's there, or the guy who's there with him, is kind of like thinks it's very funny the way he's described it. And he's talking about how he's deliberately trying not to be crass because the book is super crass. It's basically about this girl who becomes a sex worker. It starts when she's, I don't know, 10 or something, and then she becomes a sex worker and ends by the time she's like 13. It's really, really graphic in what is basically just a series of rape scenes.
This is when I was like grateful that the film is not in English, because I could play it out loud in a house with other people in it and not oh my be God. Like worried, because the film is like 90% like people reading out porn.
Yeah, I mean, there are definitely like some interesting techniques in it. Like at one point she has the men read only the women's parts, I think. And sometimes only the men's part. And when they do that, you become aware of how this book basically completely objectifies the woman, and that everything in it is from the male perspective and she has no agency. And I guess it's thought that this is – the book is anonymous but thought to be written by the guy who wrote Bambi.
Oh, my God.
And you see some of them, like, there's some insight into actor brain where people are like, oh, well, if they're making a movie of this, then it's legit and I can say – that I should treat this as legit, as opposed to being like, this is child pornography and I'm not comfortable with this. Mm. Yeah, I don't know. Like, it's definitely interesting where you see people sort of turn themselves inside out. They think that they're like, she's more or less, because the director is asking them questions off screen, is more or less non-judgmental. And allows them to choose to think that this is a legitimate text and that their responses are legitimate. And it kind of allows people to say really horrifying things and occasionally some funny and some thoughtful things. I do have some questions about like the ethics of this film. Like, what did these people think that they were going to, like, you know, it's basically an audition call for a film about Mutzenbacher, and then she's filmed the auditions and edited them into a movie. Like, did they know their auditions were going to be edited, like that was going to be the movie? Like, they seem to think that they're auditioning for real parts. So I do kind of wonder the degree to which these guys were like sort of exploited for the making of this film. But I'm assuming they had to sign release forms. So yeah, I don't know.
The jury's out.
Jury's out. It's definitely interesting. There's a lot to unpack in it. I think it's like a good conversation piece. So I think those are the highlights of our Berlinale viewing. Next week on the podcast, we will have a members-only bonus episode in which we will discuss Benadryl Cumbersome. Sorry, I mean Benedict Cumberbatch.
Good save.
We're actually intending to be – this is supposed to be a nice episode where we say nice things about Benedict Cumberbatch and his good performances and discuss why he should have been Oscar-nominated for The Courier instead of – Power of the Dog, talk about his films this year and some of his best performances. So that's our members only bonus next week. If you want to listen to that, you need to become a member at 7th-row.com/join, which will also give you access to all of our bi-weekly bonus episodes and our episodes more than 6 months old.
And make sure before you listen to that episode, you watch the film I co-starred with him in, Stuart, A Life Backwards.
And in 2 weeks, we will be back with another Berlin-themed episode in more ways than one. We talk about one of the highlights of the 2021 Berlin Film Festival competition, which has only just been released in North America, which is the German film set in Berlin in the 1930s, Fabian or Going to the Dogs, which is a very thoughtful and entertaining and wild ride about the rise of fascism in 1930s. Germany and Berlin. So stay tuned for that.
And please, if you enjoyed this episode, go and rate and review our podcast on Apple Podcasts. We would really, 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 really appreciate it if you did. It really helps us, and we always love getting reviews so much. They make our day. We'll, of course, read them out on the next episode or the next episode that we record after getting your review, and we would love to hear from you. It's always amazing to get feedback, but obviously, if you don't have time to type something out, a quick 5 stars takes a second and is also extremely helpful.
So Orla, where can people find you?
You can find me at OrlaMango on Twitter, and you can find my writing on 7th Row, and you can find me on this podcast every week.
And you can find me on Twitter at bwestcineast, bwestcineaste. You can find my writing on Seventh Row as well, 7th-row.com, and of course on this podcast every week with Orla. You can find both of us on Twitter and Instagram at Seventh Row, SEVENTHROW. And you can also get in touch with us via email if you'd like to send us a longer missive, contact at 7th-row.com. That's SEVENTH-ROW.com. We would love to hear from you. Thanks for listening.